So the final point being, you cannot have fun when you're doing math.
Not what I said.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tuesday's show. And Kristen, do you remember the time when we just had so many Democratic candidates and there was no stories, it was quiet?
We were like, oh, it's so boring. Yeah. This is so boring. And then the last
happened?
2 weeks.
Ooh, Sarah
Man,
Rodriguez.
Talk about whiplash for Sarah Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Because last week it really felt like, oh, the rumor mill was churning as far as more of the establishment behind the scenes coalescing around Sarah Rodriguez. David Crowley dropped out and endorsed her. Obviously, before that, Missy Hughes had dropped out and endorsed her, and kind of accusations from Fran Hong supporters that this was all in order to, because they were scared of Fran Hong. And so it seemed like there was a fair amount of momentum for Rodriguez as of last week. And then yesterday, the bomb of being hundreds of thousands of dollars short of where she thought she was. I mean, and this is, so we'll get into all the details of it, but Sarah Rodriguez had a presser yesterday.
I give her credit for that. She at least stood up there.
I mean,
she had to.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. It's like, she was like, a lot of politicians wouldn't do this. Like, isn't this what the whole show, The Good Wife, is based off of?
Yeah, yeah.
Politicians get up a lot and have to help, like, be held accountable. Otherwise, the rumor mill continues to run rampant as far as people have, and the discourse continues whether you inject yourself or not into the discourse.
I mean, it would have been worse if she hadn't said something publicly. And she did, I guess, and I've talked to a couple of journalists, that she took the questions, whether she answered them the way they wanted to ask the journalists. She fired her campaign manager, a woman. Her opponents are saying this is disqualifying, she's unprepared. You're closer to that side than I am. What does this mean?
I'm hearing the exact same things. As far as the text chatter yesterday was, how does she survive this? But even more so than the... Because there's something to be said as far as the difference between people who are tracking this, who are insiders, and how many people who will end up voting next month who maybe hear about this, but still support her and still like her, and it doesn't make as much of a difference. But what I don't understand is, so as we're trying to piece the numbers together, and we're doing a segment on math later, we're talking about the joy of math.
Yeah, we are.
Later on. And I was never someone who was like, oh, math is joyful.
No,
so
not for me.
Excuse me as I try to do on-air math. But at least according to the timeline that she said yesterday in her press conference, was that at the time of announcing they were doing $1 million ad buy, which was recently, she was under the impression they had $1.5 million cash on hand. The ad buy did not go through. She now has $200,000 cash on hand. But the discrepancy as far as the duplicates in her January finance report sounds like it was around, J.R. Ross just tweeted this out this morning, about $275,000 of duplicate posts with the same name, same address, same amount, which means $137,000 more than what should have been there. So how do you get from a million thinking you have like 1.5 million to only 200,000? And how does 200,000 cash on hand get you through the next 30 days?
I think this whole thing is based in sloppiness because I don't think they ever had $1 million. And I'm doing some reading as we're talking. They've talked a lot about having this $1 million, but they never, either she didn't verify it with her campaign manager, verify the books throughout the January to July process, because what do we know what's happening? Was it Thursday that the final report before the election comes out, what they have cash on hand, where the money came from, how much they've raised?
Well, that's due tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow.
That's
yeah,
tomorrow.
Wednesday. I don't know that. I think this does say something about her campaign, not just a campaign manager. How do you not know? You're responsible for all of this. I've run campaigns. I had campaign managers. I had treasurers. We always knew what everybody else was doing. How is that not a thing? And this is the same candidate, by the way, who talked about keeping I don't want to deviate too much, but keeping the budget process behind closed doors. I get what she meant, but the words were bad, and it hurt her then. This hurts her now. I think her campaign is dead.
I think her campaign's dead.
Which, here's my next question for you. So we have two candidates who dropped out, Missy Hughes and David Crowley, the county executive.
I mean, how pissed is David Crowley right now?
So what do they do?
Because she refused to apologize to him in the press conferences. That was a couple things with the press conference yesterday that I felt like left a lot unanswered. And as much as she was saying, oh, I'm taking accountability and being transparent, but she has yet to say if the campaign manager stole money, which obviously
her name is Kara Spencer,
is a crime,
by the way,
if
yes.
that happened. So
that's
we don't
why
know,
she reported it.
We don't know about that. She did not apologize to Crowley, who just got out and endorsed her, and probably got out based on bad information. And then the fact that she refused to say that the buck stops with her, right? Like, she kept trying to throw her campaign manager on the bus, which I understand. Like, if your campaign manager was lying to you and giving you bad information, that's one thing. But ultimately, like, what are you going to do if you're governor and some huge mistake happens? You're going to, like, just blame it on someone else? Like, the buck's going to stop with you.
Yeah. You're the person.
As far as taking accountability for this. And so I don't know. Like, this is the words that I heard are like just like totally toast.
Let's play the words of Sarah Rodriguez. She did a presser this afternoon. Then we'll go right to break, Jazz. Let's listen to it. We'll comment more. You can weigh in 855-616-1620. I think her campaign's dead. She may still have some support. She's not going to win the primary. What do you think? Here is the candidate for governor, current Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez.
I would say that most people are not going to stand in front of this many cameras and microphones to talk about fixing an error. That's what I am here doing. And that's what you want to see in leadership and what you want to see in your next governor.
Are you hosting an event, launching something new, wanting to get the word out about your part of the state? Be a featured guest on the WTMJ Experience Wisconsin show. Share your story, promote your event or business, and connect with fans all across the state. I'm John Mercier. I'd love to interview you. We reach listeners from Milwaukee to Madison, Green Bay to La Crosse, everywhere in between. It's Experience Wisconsin. Ready to shine a spotlight on your business or company? Email me, john@WTMJ.com for more information. john@WTMJ.com.
Hey, it's Kristen Bry from Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. You know what my voice sounds like, but if you've met me in person, you might say that my smile is my signature. That's why I trust Dr. James Michaels and the team at Economowoc Dental Care. Yes, I drive all the way from Milwaukee to Economowoc to see Dr. Michaels and his incredible staff. Because when you find a dental team that makes you feel comfortable, listened to, and cared for, that drive is worth it. Dr. Michaels has been practicing in Economowoc for more than 25 years, and his approach is simple. Treat people the way you want to be treated. So whether you're due for a cleaning, thinking about cosmetic options, or just need a dental home where you feel at ease, call Economowoc Dental Care. The number's 262-567-7224. Economowoc Dental Care with Dr. James Michaels, the team I trust with my smile.
Dave Spano, CEO of Annex Wealth Management, a fee-only fiduciary.
Fee-only fiduciary really further separates the folks that either say fiduciary some of the time or best interests altogether. And it's not just that alone. It is, of course, everything else that we can bring to the table that just isn't asset management. It is estate planning, tax planning, financial planning, all of it wrapped together in one transparent fee.
Know the difference with Annex Wealth Management. Click the Get Started button at annexwealth.com.
Starting with the Wisconsin governor's race on this Tuesday. Thanks for listening. As always, the Point Taken. If you miss any or all of our shows, easy way to find it, WTMJ.com or wherever you get your podcasts, just search Point Taken, Kristen and Steve. Look, it's a bad look. I mean, if you blame it on Kara Spencer, her finance person on her campaign, or she wouldn't answer that basic question, and a lot of reporters peppered with that question, does the buck stop with you? And doesn't the answer have to be yes?
Well, most importantly, I think, is just still an understanding of how do you get from thinking you have $1.5 million to only $200,000?
Well, the answer is she probably doesn't know yet. That's my guess. So how do you answer a question you don't know the answer? You can't make stuff up. So she doesn't know, which is sort of problematic. Because, again, if you run a campaign this important, you are considered one of the front runners. You're a lieutenant governor. You're going off the ride you've had with Tony Evers for the last few years. I think this is something that voters should be asking. If you can't manage your campaign from a leadership perspective, why would we trust you with a state? And I still think Crowley and Hughes one, deserve an apology, but two, they got out on bad information. They now are in this weird position. So do they pull their endorsements? What does that mean?
I haven't seen any endorsements pulled yet. Have you?
No. I just, this whole thing is nuts to me. And I'm sorry. I don't like this term because I use it too much. It shows that you're not ready for prime time to me. You're not ready to be the top leader of the state. You're just not. Because you don't know at this important, critical junction of your campaign, going into the less than 30 days, it's a mess. You're holding a news conference where you put all your stooges behind you. They're all nodding in agreement. And let's move forward. When you have a story like this, we're going to look back. Because the answer is not forward. It's backwards. What happened in January to July? It's backwards. Forward is going to tell us nothing. What'd you do in the last 6 months? Sarah Rodriguez, lieutenant governor. I have to give her a title. This stuff is nuts to me.
Well, and the, you know, obviously the question is, I don't think she will drop out. Because she probably still has.
She's not going to drop out.
She probably still has polling that says where she is in the polls makes her competitive. I think there's probably, as long as she doesn't lose major endorsements. But yet I still don't know. I mean, this is, I think you do see, I forgot who posted this yesterday, but the prediction markets and where they went after this news broke yesterday.
I didn't see that.
It's just a straight line up for Fran Hong.
All right, so this is a contrarian text, but I like to read contrarian text. 414. I wasn't going to vote for her anyway, but way to punish her for doing the right thing at a time when most politicians don't.
I push back on that. First of all, I don't think we're punishing her. I think this is a talk show and the a political talk show where we talk about the politics of the day. So punishing her is harsh.
Voters will punish her.
But I also, eventually this was going to come out.
Yeah.
Right? As far as her getting in front of this, is that doing the right thing? Or is that just making a move before the inevitable happened? And it looks even worse because a reporter breaks the story instead of you.
I said, I gave her some credit for standing up there. Not easy to do. When things are bad, I've been in very tense situations as an elected official. Not easy. High tension makes for, you can make mistakes. You say the wrong thing. You often go too far, not just speaking to the facts of what you're talking about. This, not easy. None of that's easy, and it couldn't have been easy for her. But again, if your argument, and a lot of texters are making the argument, she can't be responsible for everything. This is a critical piece. Because you are about to buy $1 million of ads across the state in the less than 30-day run-up to the primary election. And people are already voting in many places by their mail-in ballots. You can't, you have to, every day on a campaign, for you have to say, all right, status report, where are we at? Unless this person, Kara Spencer, because again, that's the person we're talking about, that's who the Elections Commission is going to be looking at, her conduct in relation to this campaign. Someone has to know that something's not right here. And basically, I think it was found out because there was unpaid bills.
Yeah, it was an unpaid invoice.
I mean, this stuff should not happen. And whether Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez would make a great governor, I'm not a Democrat. I don't know. And maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. But these types of things are what people base their voting decisions on. How you manage your money. And what's going on in the state right now that people are talking about when it comes to how they make decisions about how they vote. Gas and groceries, affordability. Someone can't manage their own campaign dollars. Money, which, by the way, in the most cases, individual donors gave her. So either you lied about the amount, somebody misspent the amount. We'll find that out. That's what the Wisconsin Elections Commission is going to do. Again, stop with the delegation stuff. She's responsible. She's the candidate.
But it's also something, because when you hand in your finance reports, is there not someone on the other end of that who's also checking it?
You would think.
Because that was my thing as far as, so I spent my afternoon yesterday going through a spreadsheet of 850 plus quotes from the documentary and going line by line and assigning which episode I think it's going to go to. And that's, you know, a fraction, but not that small of a fraction of 2,095 donors. So that's in her January finance report. There was 2,095 individual donors,
yeah.
Which if you've spent any time in Excel, it sounds like a lot, but that's also not that many to have to eyeball, let alone do like a V lookup,
right,
as far as to account for duplicates. And so again, even on the receiving side of this, how did no one until now flag duplicate entries? Like, what is the process once you hand in those finance reports? Everyone's like, all right, looks good. No one looks at it?
Maybe that's how it works, and maybe there aren't an extra set of eyes. A lot of people are sort of saying that they think that she did the right thing by coming out. I guess if that's what you're gonna
if this isn't a deal breaker for you,
then you're good, right?
Then vote for her. Like, that is, if she's, as long as she's in the race, and this wasn't that big of a deal to you, we're not telling you not to vote for her. I'm not voting for her.
The reality on the ground in Wisconsin right now is this race is wide open.
Yeah.
Whatever your candidate is, yeah, Joel Brennan, you'd have to make a massive leap. That probably not going to happen. But for the other candidates who are considered front, it's wide open because she's got a chunk of
votes. Kayla Royce came out yesterday with $1.2 million raised. So she's the first one to announce her own finances. And we'll see what everyone else has raised.
It's going to be illuminating because you're going to see how much money they really have. And this is just sort of a precursor to the big release of those numbers. You can keep texting if you want to. We can certainly read some of those. We're going to tell you a story, real quick story, about what's happening to Lindsey Graham's Senate seat. Sort of a weird... It's the first time I can find of a non-wife getting the... So we'll talk about
that.
Point taken. 620 WTMJ. I think John on the text line, the Saturday Unlimited WTMJ talk and text line nails it. Sloppy bookkeeping or stealing voters deserve the truth before the primary election. So get busy, Wisconsin Elections Commission. Find out what the story is. If indeed she had no knowledge, Sarah Rodriguez, Lieutenant Governor of the state of Wisconsin, candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. If she didn't know or couldn't have known, then we should know that so people can make the right decision on their ballots in August. I think that's a pretty straight way to look at it. Read the Lieutenant Governor campaign. Move on. Why not the same false outrage with massive historic graft and corruption in federal? I'm anti-graft and corruption all the time.
No, I feel like we do talk about Ken Paxton, and we've talked about the grift of the presidential administration. Just because we're not talking about it today doesn't mean we haven't talked about it.
I assume this is directed at me. Is it because she's a woman? I don't think so, right? What does that have to do with it?
Doesn't matter. Anyways.
That seems dumb.
So, and I guess I have my initial reaction. We're moving on, by the way.
Yes.
That was a sloppy segue. So, as of yesterday, obviously the big news coming out of the weekend was Senator Lindsey Graham had died unexpectedly. And yesterday, the appointment to his Senate seat for the remaining of this term, because he was up for re-election, went to his sister, Darlene Graham Norden. And so she's going to be doing the rest of his term. And like it's actually a very sweet story as far as what their relationship is, because they're over about 10 years apart, I think maybe 9 years apart. He was 22 when both of their parents had died. She was only 13. He went ahead and adopted her, which gave her his veterans benefits. And obviously they were very close. And we all know Lindsey Graham, not married, so there was no wife.
Which is
so
traditionally
that was interesting, because my first reaction was,
that's how it usually works.
How do you just appoint someone? Because ultimately, there's only 100 senators. And so what does that do to the people who are represented, usually by someone they elect, to have someone who has no background in it? But I guess if it's typically a spouse, it's not totally unprecedented. But the other thing it made me think was, as we talk about whether it's an appointment of someone who may or may not know what they're doing, or, you know, as we have a very elderly makeup of the Senate, like, is a senator only as good as their staff?
I would argue this, the staff does most of the work.
So, like, as she sits, is this Darlene sits in this seat, and the fact that apparently Lindsey Graham's staff has been with him for a very long time, like, she will be fine because the staff knows what they're doing.
I mean, I'll say my outrage. I don't like the whole ceremony. I would just leave it empty until someone is elected to it, whether that's an interim election, if it happens early, or just a regular
election.
Can't do
that. They need the votes.
I know that's the political reality, but this stuff seems silly to me. And whether you're a spouse or a sister or brother, whatever it is, they haven't earned it. Ultimately, the voters of South Carolina get to make their case for it, yay or nay. I don't like it. You know, one of the things I get the most heat about is when I talk about kids living in their parents' basements. And I throw it out a lot just because I know it irritates some people.
Well, it irritates you.
I think it irritates a lot of people like me, yes.
That not, people are still not, living at home?
That people are just, they never get out of their parents' house. It's like, it's the whole, I'll do a rant if you want one. It's the whole, my parents are my best friends. Shut up. They're your parents. Stop that nonsense.
So you brought this up. So 49% of adults under age 30 are currently living with their parents, which is up 12 percentage points from 2019. Mm. And the caveat here, or the asterisk here, is that some economists are putting that figure lower, and note that the Fed study that this has cited doesn't distinguish between children who are living with their parents' homes versus parents who are living in their children's
homes.
That's
a problem with the data.
And so basically, it also said that 55% of young adults who move back home, so it means they did leave and they've moved back home, mm-hmm. which everyone in this Wall Street Journal article, that was the case. They had moved out and now they are back home instead of just never, like, totally failing to launch. But it said 55% of young adults who moved back home said it was because of financial necessity. But why did the other 45% move home, you think?
Good question.
Right?
Lonely.
Which I think is something, and so I'm going to take the opposite stance of you. I don't think this is a bad thing. As we talk about the fact that we have a housing shortage, and part of that is to do the fact that so many people are living alone, right? This is the first time in modern history where there's this many people who are single, who don't have roommates. And so what that has done to our housing supply, I'm not saying that's the only reason we have a housing shortage, but it is one of the factors of the, for a long time, you either lived in multi-generational homes, had your nuclear family where, you know, at least two adults living in there, had roommates, but now more and more people are living alone. And so that is increasing the amount of housing that we need. And so I think, as someone, a big shock here, as far as the loneliness epidemic, finances, there's all these reasons why I actually think this is probably a good thing to have adults living with their parents, so long as they're all getting along.
So I'm not a mental health professional, nor am I a doctor or somebody who knows the science of you know, how relationships, family relationships shouldn't work. But does part of this story to you suggest that if you just maintain your nuclear family, whether you move back in or you stayed there forever, it doesn't allow the person to be able to communicate with people who aren't family, to make relationships beyond their family experience. Families are great. We all want better, stronger families. Awesome. But when you don't have an experience that's away from that, if you can't relate to people who aren't your family, what good are you to society?
But I feel like that's a huge leap.
Of course. I said it was not scientific.
Yeah, like that's a huge leap as far as people who, because again, I think the pattern here is more often people who have moved out and then moved back in, especially since the pandemic. And I don't, in this article, we didn't have the breakdown of people who just have never left their parents' home.
Yeah, which
I'd love
to see as
well. That's a very white thing, right?
I don't know that that's true.
Black communities, Hispanic communities, Asian communities, it was much more, especially immigrant communities, it was much more normal to have multi-generational living versus like you, like flying the coop and empty nesters and all the bird analogies.
You don't have to confine it to the United States, internationally. But that's also often grandparents or great grandparents. It's that way, not more young people at the bottom end.
Sure. But also, like, there was a New York Times opinion this day today is like the amount of, you know, my sandwich generation and Gen X, of just a generation older than me, now taking care of their aging parents and those parents moving in. And so I just don't think this is.
You don't see no negatives to this at all.
I think on an individual basis, if you have issues with your parents, I think this speaks to the a lot of other factors, like we're going to be talking about later in the show today, amount of Gen Z who are going into the trades instead of going to college. And so I think there's a lot of things shifting in our economy as far as cost of living that doesn't seem to be coming down, having enough housing, isolation. I think probably if you are in a toxic relationship with your parents, if you are not, like, if you're using it as a crutch to not go out and actually get a job, like, there's certain situations where, yeah, probably in that dynamic, not the best for the person, but as a trend on the whole, I don't think it's a terrible thing.
So no age, if you're 45 and you're still living with your parents, cool. There's no downside to this at all. As far as the maturation of one's personality, communication skills.
I just said that if that is the case, but like I lived at home for a little while. When I first got back in 2020, I, you know, it was the pandemic and I was not alone as far as how many adult children decided to ride out the pandemic with their parents. And like, in a lot of ways, it was great. Like, it was as far as
that's a one of every 100-year pandemics.
No, I understand, and the circumstances that led to it is one thing, but as far as understanding the reality of what it was like to live with my parents at 33 and I turned 34 that summer, the shared responsibility, like my ability to help my parents, like the story I told when we caught the bat, the fishing net. And so like the ability for me to who has a more physically capable and able body than either my parents did at the time. So things I could help with them with, obviously my mom was cooking dinners every night and stuff like that. So there was something nice as far as having more bodies in the house to help with the responsibilities of taking care of a house.
Just to clarify, this has nothing to do with taking care of someone that's sick. Someone said, shame on me. If there's a reason why you're there, absolutely. Help your parents out. Help your grandparents out. It has nothing to do with that. But everything that's said in our culture has a kernel of truth. There's a whole world, meme world of guys living in their parents' basements. You think any of that is it's all fake and weird and just people having fun with it? Or you think there's some value to that statement that says basically, get the hell out of your house and get your life going? That's what I'm saying. You don't think you see no kernel of truth in any of that?
I see a kernel of truth.
Okay, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but I think that's fine. I mean, it's fine if you think there are certain people who are the failure to launch and the arrested development and
another,
whatever you want to say.
Another cliched term, but that's exactly what it means.
Yeah.
Get out there. There's value into being your own person.
But is there value if it's truly for financial reasons, is it value to go be broke and I'm borderline homeless?
I agreed with that qualifier. There are certain circumstances where it absolutely makes sense. But
so what are the circumstances that you're like, this is a bad thing?
If you have a job and you work 40 hours a week and the only reason you're living in your parents' house is to get, you know, free rent, you don't have to pay for anything, you're using under the guise of saving for your home, whatever it is, get on your own and meet some people. I don't understand this mindset where now everyone's just pushing everything off. I get the whole parents are my best friends thing. Make some other friends. Your parents are awesome. I love family relationships. We have great ones in our family. Make some other friends. Because the problem in our culture, in my opinion, we're not making other friends. The only way you get to do that is to get out there and actually meet people. Not on your frickin' phone, not texting, not messaging, not playing games together online. You actually go to a real physical place, whatever that is in your world, and actually meet other people. Text me if I'm right. Someone's got to agree with me on this. 855-616-1620.
Text if you think I'm right. 855-616-1620.
I'm sure we'll get those. But let's not pretend this is not a real thing. Guys living in their parents' basement is a meme and a storyline because it actually exists. Quick break. It's running about 50-50 on the text line. Thanks for everyone who's taking the time to listen and respond. Look, if there's a reason why you're there, absolutely full support. Families are great. We need more families. But you got to get out at some point. You got to get on with your life. You got to be. Here's another way to look at it. We need you to get in a relationship and have some more kids because we got a population problem in this country. That's not going to make any of this even better, or worse, actually.
So it seems like your biggest issue with this is more of like the delayed maturity of what it takes to be a response. Like there was delayed responsibility of what it means to be on your own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
And also, because as producer Jazz just pointed out, you can also live alone and just be in your basement trolling people on the internet.
Here's what I
That's
love
not a precursor to like, being with your parents is not a precursor to be one of those types of people.
Yeah, but if it's right, it's right. It's sort of this one of those indicators, flashing indicators of what's wrong. Anecdotal. We baby our kids. We smother our kids. We have the rise of helicopter parents.
That I agree with.
We don't let them fail. We don't let them go out on their own and maybe they can't make their rent. Maybe they have to move back home. We don't let enough of our children do that. You have to learn. This is not about hating. I love strong parents. I love families who stick together. I love families who don't make politics the divider and they break their families. That all sucks. And we've talked endlessly about that. I just want young people to have the best opportunity. And I think, and I'm saying this as a parent of two daughters, too many people are smothering their kids. They're not letting them be fully functional adults. And yes, it's anecdotal. Much of what we talk about on a talk radio is anecdotal. We're not scientists, for God's sakes. But there's a kernel of truth to this. And if there wasn't, it wouldn't exist. That's all I'm saying.
All right, I actually got a good anecdote about teachers and parents and kids related to this topic when we come back.
I won't pay. Text line's popping. I love it.
Text line is popping.
I love that. Lots of commentary, a lot of different nuance to the story. I get it. It's not easy, but I say it's necessary.
I mean, I think this comes back to you have to do what works for your family. But I also agree with you as far as I subscribe to the idea that as a parent, you obviously, part of that is loving your child unconditionally, but it is also preparing them to be a successful adult with or without you, mm-hmm. right? And so I do agree as far as I am not a helicopter parent, maybe to a fault, but that's okay. But one of the things I saw a panel yesterday or a video of a panel yesterday, and a teacher was talking about one of the biggest disservices we did to kids was putting their grades online. Because prior to that, as a kid, especially as like middle school or high schooler, you had to go advocate for yourself when you got handed back a grade and learn how to talk to your teacher and negotiate with your teacher and figure out what you had to do to improve your grade. And then as things got pushed to online and parents had access to your grades, this teacher was talking about, you know, and I understand, she's like, I'm a parent, I understand we want what's best for our kids, we want to protect them. She's like, but we took that responsibility away from kids, because she's like, I almost only hear from parents now advocating for their kids on their on the kids' grades. And I think that is one of the many examples of parents stepping in versus teaching your kid how to advocate for themselves with their teacher.
Here's a generational difference that I've heard from so many people I know in all these generations that I come in contact with all my life. The difference was back in education, when you had that report card and you failed in school, your parents didn't go after the teacher. They went after your know what. Now, and I'm married to a teacher, and I know a lot of teachers, and I talk to a lot of school board members, presidents, the whole thing, administration. The biggest thing that parents do now is they criticize the educational process or the teacher. That's the difference.
When did Kathy say that shifted for her? Like, when did she start to notice that change
20
in
years,
parents?
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
So basically like the beginning of this century.
Yeah, one generation, 20 years. Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. That was exactly what I was about to ask as far as what shifted in the culture of parenting.
If you're a teacher out there, am I right on this? Because I've heard it from so many teachers. They used to say, how can I help my kid? What are you doing
with
this
test? Interesting, because that would have been part, because I mean, if that's parents, because I was in the early 2000s, if we're talking about if it happened in the early 2000s, I was in high school from 2000-2004. So we're talking like the younger half of boomers as parents starting to be the helicopter parents.
Yeah. But when you have a breakdown in sort of the protocols of how education is completed and advocated for, when you have all that breakdown where all it is an attack, and I'll answer my own question. It's because we're a nation of arguers now. Everybody's a freaking expert on everything. They think they're an internet expert because they've read something on the internet. Their Uncle Joe told them that, you know, COVID wasn't real. That's the basis of all these arguments. Everybody just wants to argue, not understand what the problem is. And here's the problem for parents. It's your damn kid. He's not doing well enough. That's your responsibility with the teacher, but it's not going after the teacher. It's working with them. That's what's changed.
All right. When we come back, we're still going to be talking about school. Should math be joyful?
Oh, my God.
Steve's got thoughts. All right. This is next.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bryan.
Does it spark joy? Should it spark joy? No, I'm not talking about the knickknacks in your junk drawer. I'm talking about math. Should math spark joy? Well, apparently, potentially, a new math guidelines. Is that what they were trying to work on? I don't even know how to refer to them. If they're guidelines or
curriculum and
curriculum,
how we teach.
For Wisconsin.
Policy and guidance changes in how you teach math.
In that math should be joyous, which I think, unless you were someone who is innately good at math, probably never thought of math as joyful.
Full disclosure, I hate math. I mean, I can do basic math and divisions and all that stuff, but my wife is a math major
yeah.
and teaches calculus and other levels of math. I never got it. I just sucked it up and passed the test.
Did you ask her about this story at all?
I just said we were talking about it. I didn't ask
her. I would love to know her take.
Well, if she's interested, she'll text.
And I speak from a personal standpoint of, so my dad and my brother, very good at math, finance guys. My mother had, I'm sure she's listening and she's going to hate that I'm telling this story, but she was convinced that she was not good at math, didn't pursue becoming a doctor because she would have had to take calculus. I became an occupational therapist, which she was very good at that. So she was very good at science, and she was very good at like memorizing in her anatomy class at UW-Madison. So very smart woman, but for math just had this like mental block that she couldn't do it. And so then as a kid, when I came home with my times table test and I wasn't as fast as like the other kids in my class, or especially not as fast as my brother, it's a very competitive household. My mom gave me a pass as far as like, well, you're just not good at math like me. And then I became like, that was a get out of jail free card, right? It was like, and I still got B's in my math classes, but there wasn't that extra push of like, I should be getting an A. And so I do think there is something about math and how it's taught that can change a kid's perspective on math entirely. And one of the things that stood out to me in this article from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel documenting that this discussion of this type of change is happening is that I think because math is one of the few disciplines, unlike English, where there is a right answer, right? If you don't get the right answer, even if you show your work and like your thought process was correct, but you forgot one thing, like you still get it wrong. But in reality, the reason why math is, I think, very useful and I have came to appreciate it was because it does teach you how to think through problems. And so if you're only ever focused on the right answer, and I'm not saying we have to get rid of, like, if you did the work right, you still get 100%. I'm not saying that, but I do think putting the emphasis on figuring out how to think is why math is necessary, especially as we all walk around with computers in our pocket.
How you teach something certainly matters. And we were chatting about Jaime Escalante, Garfield High School, many years ago.
Stand and deliver.
He came into school where none of them could do anything, and he taught them brilliantly, so they became experts at math because of what he said, and the direct quote is, hard work by the educator, hard work by the students. And he didn't make it fun. He just, at some point it was fun because they were succeeding, they were passing tests, they were learning the stuff. It's hard work. And, you know, somewhere along the line, someone decided, and I do blame, and I'm very supportive of the educational system, administrators who try to make everything fun and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Who said education had to be fun? Learn it, get your high school diploma, then go have fun with whatever you learned. But this idea that, and I'm not opposed to having a teacher be brilliant at what they do and be creative in the process, absolutely, sign me up. And certainly Jaime Escalante was one of those people. He's long dead. He's been dead for 16 years. But he was an example of, man, you could just got to buckle down and do it. Sometimes you just got to memorize stuff.
Okay, but so apparently what we're doing right now is not working.
No.
So you think like...
But it did work for a couple generations or more. It did work just fine. And then we have current generations where it's not working. So obviously there's differences, right? How they were raised, how they look at things, the cultural influences, societal influences. So yes, you have to adapt your styles. But when you, and this is again, I'd love to hear from teachers because they're on the ground. They see it every day. When you make it too easy, I just read a text from a teacher that said basically we dumbed down the process and you just keep taking tests over again. And if you're a school district, you know what I'm talking about. Take it again till you pass. Okay, whatever. But that's not how real life works. You don't get to keep failing at your job like six times and then, oh yeah, you got it right, Bill. Congratulations, you got that client. But you failed like six times. You cost us a lot of money. It's not how the real world works. Sometimes things
are
going to be
tough. So what is the, like in your mind, what is the goal? Is the goal to get like math proficiency up?
Yes.
So then
here's
how do you, like if they're finding creative ways to get to that goal, why is that a bad thing?
Reward teachers. There's been a war on teachers. That has to stop immediately. And again, I'm biased. Fully admit that. Married to one, know a lot of them. Reward teachers. And the game, and I don't know how deep in the weeds you want to go on this, but the game that districts are playing now is they up the starting salary, and then they cap them 3 years later. They can never make much more money than what they started. That's the game that's being played, where most jobs, when you have 10 years, 15 years, you can make a really decent living wage. So that's one thing. Two, reward teachers that are actually demonstrating through test performance, through the achievement of their students, that they're getting the message across.
But where does that money come from?
Where does the money always come from?
I know, but I'm saying this, there's already a situation where, like, teachers aren't making that much. Districts are going to referendum again and again. Where does the money come from to be able to reward teachers if that's what you're saying?
I just had this conversation last night.
Okay.
When I drive by a school district and I see a multi-million dollar sports complex, the first question I ask of that district, if I had a chance to, so you devoted tens of millions of dollars to sports or band or whatever and not to the actual teachers and the educational system. Why? Okay. Our operations.
Fine. And
more than fine. That's
but accurate. In MPS, how many multi-million dollar sports facilities are you saying?
MPS has more money going to their students than any other district. Like, the money thing is only part of the story. Throwing money at a problem will only fix it if you have a solution to the problem. Otherwise, you're just throwing money.
Well, that's
at
what you just said. You just said the suggestion was to reward teachers.
That's part of it.
What's the other part?
Actually demand that kids are in classrooms, not on their phones, listening to students. This is another back to the basics for me. We don't let them take all the other electives until they get the basics right. We don't let kids wander through the halls of high schools unattended without a hall pass. That's sort of we had detentions back when I went to, you know what that was, right?
I know what detention is.
Sometimes they locked you in a room for a while. It wasn't like, was it the Breakfast Club? It wasn't like that. We didn't get the dance. No dancing. We didn't get to smoke weed with the janitor or whatever the hell that was. We didn't get to do any of that stuff.
It wasn't a John Hughes movie?
Here's another one. Grade school. Cudahy school system. There were teachers that would literally beat the crap out of you if you didn't do what they told.
This is nuns, right?
Nuns.
This wasn't public school.
I had both. I went to private and public.
You had a public school teacher who would...
Not me, but I saw it.
Oh, that was still allowed?
Oh, yeah.
I knew it was in private school. I didn't know in public school.
I don't want to say his name because I...
In the 60s, they were still hitting kids.
They were still hitting kids. I love this take from Richard in Sussex. This is the oldest, whitest take ever. Yeah, you can say that, but I need a little more than that. How are you going to fix it, Richard from Sussex? What's your answer, Richard from Sussex?
But you didn't actually. Oh, his said this is the oldest, whitest take ever.
Yeah. Cheap Lord. Shot. I mean, but again, we're the one radio show that reads the negative text. I think that's his take, so we'll read it. Good Lord, he said. Teachers should get paid hourly and then the good ones will achieve. Yeah, there's all kinds of ways of looking at teacher compensation. The problem we're having is, one, the way we fund schools is totally messed up.
Great.
But it would require legislators to actually work hard to change, revise, fix that system. We don't have the leaders to do that in the current crop. Maybe we will someday. I don't know. The second thing is, school districts, stop going with the favorite new way to teach. Focus on one way, spend like 10 years doing it, and see what your results are. If you change every 3 years, you're probably not going to get good results. Come on, Steve, they say. Sorry, Steve, you have no idea the reality of most public classrooms. Really? I'm married.
Well, let's hear from some teachers.
I'm married to a teacher.
855-616-1620. Let's hear from teachers.
Milwaukee.
All right, we'll be back after this.
Math sucks. Math sucks. You don't even have to spell it. All you have to do is...
We're going to get my wife on the phone. Kathy's not going to be happy with that math sucks. She loves math. She's good at math. She teaches math. And to James... Is it James?
Dr. James.
James says, I have no idea what happens in public schools. Really, James? Been in and around education for a long time. Married to a public school teacher, James.
He did say that spent 30 years educating at-risk youth. So
thank you for that dedication. But I have a lot of ideas about public education. And I'm doing a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff with school boards, school board presidents. And I've learned a lot about all things that are happening in our districts. Some of it's money. Some of it's not. Some of it's just the changing face of education. The fashion of the week. And when it comes to, I'm dumbing it down. This is popular. Then we don't like that anymore. So we go and we pay a lot of money to do the new best thing, which doesn't work any better than the last thing. Maybe consistency. Maybe some of the old ways of teaching were working. Got us through that. Now we've dumbed it all down. From the 414, I'm married to a middle school teacher. The problem is the administration is afraid to discipline the children for fear of negative publicity or loss. I hear about this all the time.
Yeah, we talked to Will Flanders about it.
Exactly. Kids really walk the halls with impunity. I hate that. And that there's a tie from that reality to bullying as well. Additionally, my wife is the hardest working person I know, and I could get paid more to be a store manager at Panda Express. Where's the incentive? I started with reward teachers. If you're good at what you do, and look, somebody said, you're just pro-union. I was pretty critical of the teachers' union. They had too much power. WEAC dominated everything about education. That's why they got slapped down by Act 10. That's part of that story. If you were around then, you know what I'm talking about. Teachers should be rewarded, yes, but also bad teachers should be removed. And the problem with the old system was bad teachers weren't removed. They just hung around making pretty big salaries. So I can see it both ways. I lived that life, and I said, I'm biased. If you don't like what I say, I still appreciate the listen.
Do you worry at all about if you're, like, as you said, reward good teachers? Is that based off of test scores? Like, I feel like that opens the door for some perverse incentives.
Great question. So I was a manager of people. I had 60 employees for a long time, for many years, over a decade.
A lot of one-on-ones.
You mean one person saying what
like,
they think?
Like one-on-one meetings. Did you have one-on-ones with all 60 of your direct reports? You had 60 direct reports?
Yeah, so we had a weekly call. Imagine this. Before Zoom, a weekly call with 60 people. You want to schedule a call with 60 people? That's scheduling. And then four times a year, I would travel to that person's hometown and then work with them. Mm. So that was it was crazy. Busy schedule. That's why I flew all the time. Now you took me off of where I was going. Oh, what's going to be required for teachers is that we have to have the ability of administrators to be able to control their teacher staff. And that means if you're not working for us, we should be able to get rid of you without a dragged out process that in the past was how this happened. It was really hard to get rid of bad teachers. Now that's changed with Act 10 because it's sort of an at will for a lot of these teachers now. And I'm not saying that's a good thing either, because you what we've done is dumbed down, let's be honest, the people who want
to be able to, you need to be able to hire in replace of those teachers.
Yes. I think we could do better on that side of things. The other thing is, I think school districts, I made the point in the last segment, we're facing, I heard Vince talk about this not too long ago, an operational fiscal cliff for school districts. They just getting the teachers paid, getting the staff paid, getting normal bills paid. They don't have the money. So it's going to require a reset by the state, by our legislature, by the governor, whoever that is, to sort of figure this out. I don't think we have the intellectual firepower right now in the state to do that, but maybe I'll be surprised. Maybe there's a future leader out there that's going to figure this all out for us. If we don't, nothing we do is going to fix this problem. Nothing we do. We've created a mess. Now we have to somehow correct it. And I'm not, in the world of complainers we live in, and I'm one of them, I'm not sure we have the rigor to do that.
Let's come back and talk about that, because I want to dig in more as far as what you're seeing, what's lacking in order to actually fix this. So stay with us on Point Taken.
Well, that's a misnomer. We definitely need education. We need strong teachers. We need districts who are willing to make bold choices. We need parents who support the educational system, not just argue on behalf of their students. I'm not saying you shouldn't make that case if you feel it's justified, but that's what it's become. So you asked me a question. What was the question?
Well, the bigger question was, you were saying you were doubting the firepower we had, which was, I wanted to press you a little bit more on specifics of that. Is that the governor? Is that the DPI? Is that the legislature? Because it feels like at any given district level, because I know you're talking to a lot of school board members for a project that you're working on, like the incentive structures for a given district is survival of our district. And yeah. So following the rules as they are, whether it's open enrollment, like we're going to do what we need to do to survive for our operational budget.
The other and district our, be damned.
Right?
Yeah.
And so at a statewide level, that becomes the state legislature, DPI, and the governor making decisions for all of students that is best for all of the state. And so is that where you're saying we don't have the firepower?
Start with the governor. He's an education governor. I think he's failed miserably on this because we have not resolved the funding problem. We have a superintendent of public instruction, Jill Underly, who also has had serious, serious missteps and mistakes. And again, we need school districts, the administration side, and school boards to work together. One of my interviews that I just did a couple weeks ago, a school board president made this point. The administrator of the school, the superintendent of the school district, is the CEO of the district. With all the powers that they have, they're often the most highest paid person in the taxing district, by the way, too. They make a lot of money. They have to be respected. If you don't have the right one, get them out of there. But they have to be respected for what they do in leading a district. That's their job. So there's a lot of different ways we can look at this. Funding problem has to be fixed by the legislature with the approval of the governor. Obviously, has to sign off for it. I don't have every possible answer on how that might happen, but throwing money at the problem is not the way it works, and it's not going to fix the problem. We need parents to support school districts and teachers. Teachers have to be better. I'm not just, someone said you're just a unionist. I'm not a unionist. I think you should get rid of bad teachers. The problem with WEAC was you never could get rid of bad teachers, and that's why they got slapped down by Act 10.
So the final point being, you cannot have fun when you're doing math.
Not what I said.
All right, so if you're watching the YouTube live stream right now, which you can always do by texting WATCH to 855-616-1620, Steve and I both unplanned
white shirts.
Wore white shirts today, which both are showing off our tans very nicely.
You were outside for 5 hours.
So who is Tanner? If you're watching right now, who is Tanner, Steve or me?
Yeah.
You think you are.
I was looking at all the stuff I've seen, but with this lighting, it's closer. Well, you did spend 5 hours
outside.
Spent
5 hours in the sun on. Yeah. There's a reason why I'm not showing off that sweet tan line that I got on Sunday. But are you spending time outside? Or are you acting like you're in Arizona in the summer and just living in the air conditioning this week? Because it is hot again.
I got home yesterday and Kathy was watering everything in the backyard, and I think we were getting ready to sprinkle the backyard. And I spent like an hour out there. I was dragging. It just, the heat was, it was like 90 something. It was just wearing me down. And today's warmer than that. I guess for me, we're so used to air conditioning now. You go in the house, I actually had like a quarter zip on because it was cold. That's how cool, it was 71. Is that like a normal setting? I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was cold in the house. But then you get outside, it's like a furnace. You could wear like nothing and still be hot. I wouldn't do that to my neighbors, but. Although I would be better tanned.
You would be better tanned.
Yes. So what do you, when you're like, I told you this story before the show. I don't remember if it was when I lived in Illinois or was in Wisconsin, we had neighbors, they're adults. When it got super hot, they'd fill up a kid's pool. Like, you know, those they have metal sides or like 3 feet high. They filled up with ice cold water and then they just.
It wasn't like an inflatable pool?
It wasn't inflatable. It had a plastic bottom, but it had like almost metal sides. They probably don't make them anymore.
Okay.
And they'd fill it up to like 2.5 feet, and then just sit in the pool, like ice cold hose water.
Yeah.
Not a bad idea.
Did they not have air conditioning?
I don't think so. This is, you know, 30 years ago. I didn't have air conditioning 30 years ago. I had put it in my house.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And we talked about this last time, for the last heat dome heat wave, as far as the amount of people in, amount of homes in Milwaukee County that don't have air conditioning.
Well, here's what I don't do. I don't bitch about the heat. Because we spent all winter waiting for these 3 months. So I suck it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have access to
apologize for the swear word,
air conditioning, about me. I don't think you should be complaining about the heat. It is very dangerous for people who do not have access to like cooling centers and air conditioning and like are stuck outside. That is a very different situation as far as how dangerous the heat can be. But I tend to agree with you. Not that we shouldn't be considered concerned about the fact that the hottest 10 years on history are the last 10 years and the trajectory of where we're going and the fact that a lot of our infrastructure, like I was just reading an article this morning for the UK, where it's like, UK is not built for this time of kind of heat, right? And so the rethinking of our infrastructure, the rethinking of our technology that like can survive in this kind of heat as we get hotter and hotter is another thing. But in the day-to-day, I like the summer, so I'm...
Yeah, I mean, I go to Vegas and it's 115. Now I'm sitting by a pool having a Miami Vice cocktail, but I mean...
What goes into a Miami Vice cocktail?
It's rum and something. I don't know. Okay. I just drink them. I'm not making them. I don't know if I can even read this one. Read the text from Lauren and see if you think we can read it. It's funny, but I didn't want to offend an ethnic group for no reason. It is something that we wait so long for, and I feel like you got to get out. I don't want to be in the house when it's... So I was outside in the afternoon. And frankly, here's a great thing. If you're watering, you will know this. If you have a hose and you're watering, the water that comes out of that hose is cold. That cools you down. So you're doing two things. You're cooling yourself down, and you're watering plants and flowers and trees and all that stuff that need the water. So you're double dipping there. So that's a good tip. Can we read that one, you think?
Sure. Lauren from the 414 said, we used to put our feet in buckets of cold water and we called them Polish pools.
I can say that
because I have Polish heritage. This is her heavy.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny. Yeah.
That was in New York. That was a friend of mine had, I forgot exactly what, I think it was just a huge blow up kids pool. And this was in Brooklyn and they had a roof access at their building. And I think we went over there one day where they're having a quote unquote pool party. And I think they fit about 10 people in that kid pool. Which was very impressive. I said, also when I lived in Brooklyn and didn't have air conditioning, and it would be so hot in the summer, just sitting in front of a fan, eating popsicle after popsicle after popsicle, trying to cool off.
So two things. One, from my old elected official background, if a city or a community or an organization that has a cooling center, make sure people know about it. And whatever, that's your Facebook page, that's your social media, email, whatever, tell people, because not everybody's always clued in, and if they're sitting in their house and it's like 95 degrees, that's not healthy, especially for older Americans, older Wisconsinites. So make sure they know about it. And I was gonna say, I wish I would have. How long will it take for someone will scold us on being tan? And we just got that.
That one.
It's a health risk, not something to brag about. So you're not a fan of Texter from the 920 is not a fan of George Hamilton, the actor who was famously known for his dark, deep dark tan. Just having some fun in the summer on a hot day. That's all.
That's all.
Do we need to be scolded about everything? I don't know. Maybe it's the heat.
Or the humidity.
Or the humidity. This is not an endorsement of the Olive Garden restaurant chain, but they're bringing back their infinite. What are you laughing about?
We'll talk about it next. We'll tease it for the final segment. You a fan of taxidermy?
I have taxidermy some things, yeah.
We'll talk about that in the next segment. But pasta. Let's talk pasta.
So I wasn't aware of the first time they did this. Apparently they sold out 24,000 of these cards that basically give you a subscription plan that gives you unlimited pasta for 13 weeks for $100.
At?
Olive Garden.
Olive Garden.
Poor man's Carrabba, but, everyone likes what they like, as my sister-in-law tells me. Here's something, and I'll tie it to the heat thing. Filling your gut with pounds and pounds of pasta, probably not good in a high heat, stressful environment.
So you're...
I'm making the connection, yeah.
You're making the connection that maybe this is not the best time for this campaign for Olive Garden?
No.
Because it's in Wisconsin. Pasta in the summer, not desirable.
So I'll make it personal.
I guarantee they still sell out.
Oh, yeah. And probably in minutes. I was a big... When I was younger, like in my early 20s and late teens, I was a big fan of the all-you-can-eat. And we took it to the limit.
Unlimited breadsticks?
Everything. Now.
You mean specifically at Olive Garden or
no,
any place that had all you can eat, you were like, sign me up.
In my era, all you can eat was the way restaurants made. That's their thing. Because they knew that in the era of 18-year-old drinking age, you didn't just eat, you also drank. So that was that reality. But I go into, there's not a restaurant that I ever would go into now where I have more of anything. I would eat what I have, sometimes not even that. That's an old man thing. I don't overeat. Thanks to Milwaukee Weight Loss. Good product sponsor there. I just don't get it. Like, is this the message that, like, why would you want to send that message? We're talking about obesity, and that's the way they want to, maybe the breadstick thing. Do one of the things. I don't know. It seems nuts to me.
I mean, it's probably still a better deal.
All you have to do is...
If you get this subscription, I would imagine if you go enough times, it's still per meal, even if you're not eating, like, three bowls of pasta every time, it averages out to still be a better deal than...
Yeah, so if you order four plates of chicken Alfredo, you break even.
How many times?
Four times.
Oh, yeah. So if you're going all the time, if you marry into a family like I did that loves Olive Garden, I'm surprised Michael Sampson might get this.
Mm. Why don't you just go to a real Sicilian restaurant?
I mean, we could do that too. Where is that? I don't even know where the closest Olive Garden is to
76 and Layton-ish. Okay. Yeah.
That's what we did in our honeymoon. One of the things that we did, there was, so we went to Curacao and Aruba for our honeymoon, and we were there for 14 days, which was like the longest vacation I think I've ever taken. It was pretty long for me. And there was one day that we just decided, again, we'd had a lot of sun because we'd just been going to the beach every day. We went to go see Black Panther 2 in one of the places that was a movie theater, and there was an Olive Garden in the complex. And so Olive Garden in Aruba, they had it. Still
now,
pretty good.
I've eaten at Olive Garden, not in the last 20 years, but I have experienced it.
Breadsticks, they're very good.
I heard their salads are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and salad and breadsticks is a thing apparently at Olive Garden.
Yeah, and their soup.
Soup, never, I don't think I might have had minestrone.
They're like vegetable minestrone soup, yeah, it's good.
It's hard to mess up a minestrone. It's a good soup. Good, healthy soup. Better than that chicken noodle soup that everybody's throwing in your cup. It is. It's just better for it. The beans. Legumes. Legumes.
Legumes.
Legumes. Is that what, that's how you say it?
I think so. Legumes.
Legumes. Legumes.
Someone will correct us.
Look at me speaking French.
So anyways, yeah, the Olive Garden is bringing back the unlimited infinite pasta pass.
Never first ending, time since 2019.
Pasta pass. And so when does this actually go on sale? It's going to be 13 weeks of unlimited pasta for $100. Mm. And you better get on it. I think it starts Thursday at 2 p.m. Thursday. There's one of 10,000 passes available.
So you lay out $100 and then you can go crazy for, that's a long time, 13 weeks.
Yeah.
You think there's people that go, like, there's a story about this famous guy from Wisconsin. Bill said's done this story a million times. Eats two Big Macs every day for his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
You think there's people that go to Olive Garden every day of their life and they have, like, chicken Alfredo one day. They have, like, just marinara sauce one day. They have Italian sausage one day.
Probably.
Lasagna.
Probably.
That'd be wild.
Find that person. That's a good story for you.
Yeah. If you're that person, love to interview you on the podcast. I think it's an amazing story. Did you hear my comment about Olive Garden being the poor man's Carrabba's?
I did hear. I don't know. What is Carrabba's?
It's more authentic food.
Where is it?
It's right across the street from Olive Garden, which is sort of an interesting dynamic.
Oh, on 76?
Yeah, in Greenfield. Oh, okay. Yeah. I always thought that was cool. They're going head to head in this battle over Italian food. And no surprise, I side with Carrabba's.
That does not shock
and you
me.
You side with Olive Garden.
That's not true.
No?
My husband might side with Olive Garden.
All right. Mike is an Olive Garden guy.
Yeah.
What does he
the
order?
Whole family
what does he
is.
Order there? This is like stuff we don't
need to talk about. The breadsticks, the soup, the salad.
Does he strap on the feet? Would he be doing this?
Probably. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I wouldn't be surprised if
when's his birthday? Would it fall into this?
August 3rd.
Man, the timing's perfect.
Should I get him this for his birthday?
Because if he's listening, he's already. If he's not
listening. We'll see. We'll test if he's listening or not, if he brings us up later today.
I would love that. That's a good present. That's a good present.
Okay. All right. I have to set my alarm for Thursday. To make sure,
it's gonna sell
make sure
out.
I'm not on
it
air.
It sells like in 3
happening.
Minutes. It's gone.
So I know.
I mean, you got to be on that. That's your homework.
Set an alarm.
That's your homework from me to you and for Mike. Last break.
All right, Steve. So you've been paying attention to the World Cup.
I have.
Who do you think was the breakout star of the World Cup?
It was that blonde-haired guy from
Erling Haaland.
Yeah, Haaland.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the star from Norway.
Yeah.
And partially because I think everyone got really into the road chant for
can't
Norway.
Get enough of it.
In general, I can't wait to go to Norway. The people seem amazing. The team seems amazing. But he also just had like a very dry sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And so he has emerged through his own social media kind of as a new star. I think he's got up to like 65 million followers on Instagram or something.
Nice.
So he got home and there's now pictures of him as what do you think he brought home with him as his, it was not it was not the golden boot. It was not
big thing of ranch dressing.
He might have done that, but that was not what he carried off the plane. He carried off a taxidermied raccoon drinking a whiskey bottle.
Oh, nice. Where did he find that?
In Dallas.
Oh, that makes sense.
Guess how much it cost? I have no, see, for me, when I saw this,
$500.
I have no idea how much 500? Taxidermied, is that the verb? Is like past tense, taxidermied?
I don't know. You just coined it.
I did not know they were this expensive. It was $750.
Yeah, that stuff's not cheap.
I mean, I guess it's like...
It's a mount.
Yeah. Do you have... what do you have?
I used to have a pheasant. I don't have anything taxidermied anymore. I used to have a pheasant that I shot. Yeah.
All right. But it was quite the souvenir to bring home with him. It's a raccoon just drinking an empty whiskey bottle.
He should be a commentator, not the play-by-play, but just the extra guy. He would be great doing that.
I would think he's still got a career ahead of him, so maybe once he retires.
Yeah, I mean, he's a young dude, right?
He's like 24, 25, I think.
And he's probably... Everybody knows Messi and some of the other, the great players, but as far as, young person popularity, he's the guy, right?
No, I don't think before this tournament he was necessarily the guy.
Now.
I think most people who knew soccer well knew him or football. I didn't know who he was before this tournament. I certainly am following him now. But the big up and comer is the Spanish 17-year-old, the main, and he's playing today, right? Isn't Spain playing France?
Spain, France.
So,
I'm picking France, by the way.
Just because of their dominance?
They've won a few, yeah.
Well, they won in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I think they came in second in 2022,
yeah,
didn't they?
Very good.
They are very good.
French team.
So we'll see.
All right. We'll do it again tomorrow?
Sounds good.
Point taken. News is next.